Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Barbara Butler, attorney license number 33965. With me today also is my client Judy Day, who is seated in the middle back there. I also represent Brian Barnes, who is also an appellant in this matter. My clients brought claims against, on behalf of HMC Limited, which is a Colorado Limited Liability Partnership, against its three general partners for their respective breaches of fiduciary duty. And while the issue of the value of the property, which was sold to one of the general partners with the approval of the other two general partners, has been extensively briefed, there are other breaches which I'd like to touch upon this afternoon, just to shine a little light on those. The first one is a lack of candor. In this situation, the three general partners entered into a contract to sell the partnership's only asset, which was 14 lots in Parachute, Colorado, to one of the general partners in November of 2005. The sale on this property didn't close for nearly 18 months later till September 2007. And in selling that partnership asset to the one general partner, we believe that there were serious breaches of fiduciary duty which occurred. And with respect to that, now we are on appeal here because the general partners hired an independent counsel to investigate these claims and to render a decision on behalf of HMC Limited as to whether or not these derivative claims should go forward. And it is our position that they should go forward. The investigation conducted by Mr. Porterfield, who was hired by the general partners, was shallow, pro forma, and half-hearted. It did not inquire into many of the substantive areas that were at issue in our underlying derivative claims. General partners owe the partnership a duty of utmost loyalty and good faith. Included in those duties is full, fair, open, and honest disclosure when dealing with partnership property. In breach of those duties, in secret and in silence, these three general partners sold the only asset of the partnership to one of their own, Mr. Hayden Rader, for what is a value substantially less than market value. Without advising the limited partners over the course of nearly 2 years, they entertained the offer, they accepted the offer, extended the offer, closed the sale, and upon sale, when they distributed what remained of the profits of the partnership, they still did not advise the limited partners of who had purchased this piece of property. In addition, the limited partners found out through the course of this that there were liens on the property that were also the result of violations of the partnership agreement. The problem with the trial court's dismissal of the derivative claims is that independent counsel failed to conduct an adequate investigation. We are prohibited from looking into the substance of his decision or the manner in which he weighed the evidence that he collected. However, it is the trial court's responsibility to ensure that the independent counsel is both independent and conducts an adequate investigation. Here, independent counsel acknowledged that it is the general partner's responsibility to determine fair market value for partnership assets prior to selling them. It's also the general partner's responsibility to try to obtain the best price possible and to seek competitive bids. And part of this test for whether fairness has occurred in dealing with partnership property is whether or not full value was received. As such, it was not adequate for independent counsel to simply find out what general partners Staskavich and Morris knew. He needed to find out what they should have known in the appropriate exercise of their fiduciary duties. He did not do that. He needed to also find out where Mr. Staskavich and Mr. Morris obtained their information so that he could determine whether or not it was reliable. He didn't do that either. He needed to find out what they should have known, not simply what they did know. He was told by Staskavich and Morris that they did not actively market the property. He was told that they did not have it appraised prior to selling it, and yet they accepted Mr. Rader's offer, and we do not know what informed them of the information that they had in the supposed exercise of their fiduciary duties. It appears that they were willfully ignorant. In addition, independent counsel did not speak with any experts regarding the value of the property. No appraisers, no real estate agents, He didn't even contact the Garfield County Assessor upon whom the sale price was ostensibly based upon the assessor's values. If he had, he would have understood that that assessor value that was on the tax rolls in 2005 was not a reflection of fair market value, but was a subdivision discounted value that is a construct under the Colorado property tax scheme and is designed to assist developers with a property tax break. It's not designed to reflect full market value. That value that the assessor had was over $2.5 million. They sold this property for approximately $250,000. The investigation conducted.
That $2.5 million was based on improvements, and this was vacant land. Is that not right?
No, Your Honor. The $2.5 million was a market value established by the assessor based on sales from 2003 and 2004.
Based on, I thought it was, the discount is a 10% discount based on it being vacant land. Is that not right?
It's based on it being, the assessor will value the market based using sales the way they value everything else. And then certain subdivisions will qualify for the subdivision discounting procedure. And what the assessor does, it's a prescripted methodology of providing a developer a tax break. And what the assessor does is first establish what market value is, and then goes on to look at other various factors like the sellout on the subdivision, an estimate of how long it'll take to sell out, some other mathematical factors that go into it to then derive at the subdivision discounted value, which is then placed on the tax roll.
Your contention is that under the Garfield County assessment procedures, the Garfield County assessor in fact determined this land is worth $2.5 million as is?
As is, yes, Your Honor, as of 2005, for the 2005 property tax year, based on sales for the prior 2 years, because the state is on a two-year property tax cycle. And so the assessors gather information for 2 years, close that out, develop their values, set the values on the property, and move forward into the next cycle.
In addition to the discounting formula, you're also saying that it was dated information. It was basically 2 years old in terms of.
Yes, that's correct. And that's significant as well because this was Garfield County in what was the midst of an oil and gas boom. So property values were appreciating significantly then.
Is that in the record?
Excuse me, Your Honor.
Is that in the record that property values were appreciating in Garfield County during that time?
I believe it's in the record with respect to our letter to Mr. Porterfield and the I'm sorry, the real estate agent that we spoke with who had laid out some estimates of value, what it's worth today, because the question of what date of value we're looking at here is a little bit cloudy. Are we looking at 2005? They extended the contract in 2006. That should have been another instance where the general partners should have taken another look at, well, how much is this property worth? And then again in 2007 when they actually closed the sale. So it's a little bit of a floating number. But our appraiser, our licensed fee appraiser that we hired to conduct an appraisal, his appraisal shows a appreciating market as well.
Just to clarify that, under Auerbach, Hirsch, and Curtis, we're not looking at what, in fact, the property was worth. We're looking at, did the independent counsel undertake an investigation adequate to make that determination himself?
Exactly. And of course, the key issue in this case is what was the property worth as a piece of it. But even if the sale price to Mr. Rader was absolutely coextensive with a market value, they still breached the partnership agreement in several key ways by simply selling it to an insider without the duties of candor that I spoke about and some other related factors. But we believe one of the most egregious facts is the wide disparity between the sale price given to Mr. Rader and what we contend is the actual value on the property.
Well, let's say he could now, the SLC could now go out and get an appraisal done or get an expert. Should it be remanded at this point to allow him to do that? Is that your position?
I don't believe a remand is appropriate. We don't believe that there are really any questions of fact necessarily as far as what Mr. Porterfield did and more importantly, what he did not do in the conduct of his investigation. He went, he did a shallow investigation, he submitted his report, and the general partners chose to rely on that report to file their motion to dismiss. And so in that instance, then I believe that they can be held to their determination at that point that he conducted an adequate investigation and that he was independent, and so they want to rely on that report, and we're saying that's unreliable. In addition to his investigation being shallow, it was also very narrow. Mr. Porterfield determined that he was going to look at only the November 2005 date and what the general partners did with respect to Mr. Rader made an offer, and Mr. Staskavich and Mr. Morris considered it and accepted it. But then he also only looked at what Mr. Staskavich and Mr. Morris did and did not focus on what Mr. Rader did in violation of his breaches of fiduciary duty. And so this investigation is sadly lacking in the depth and breadth that you would expect in order to come forward with a report and a recommendation that can be relied upon. Arguably, Mr. Rader committed the most egregious breaches of fiduciary duty in his self-dealing and his usurpation of the partnership opportunity, which was this piece of land in Parachute. And while there's nothing wrong per se with offering to purchase a piece of property from your partnership, you need to do that under the guise of full and fair, open and honest disclosure, and we don't believe that occurred here. Part of the reason we don't believe that is that Mr. Rader purchased 14 lots. This property consisted of 14 lots for roughly $250,000. And within 8 months, he had one lot sold or had a contract to sell one of those lots for $750,000, one out of the 14. Within a year, he had loans from Wells Fargo for approximately $6 million. Those, with the property being part of the collateral for those loans, not just these 14 lots. There's another 10 lots that Mr. Rader owned or purchased or somehow. So there's 24 lots implicated in the Wells Fargo loans, not just the 14 that are at issue here. He himself estimates the property, these 14 lots, to be worth $10 million at this point. Those are other key issues that Mr. Porterfield didn't look into, didn't address, because he didn't think he was looking at what Mr. Rader did and with respect to his fiduciary duties to this partnership. And finally, Mr. Porterfield didn't investigate the clear violations of the partnership agreement. The agreement itself requires that the general partners may not confess judgment against the partnership, which it appears that occurred in the liens that are referenced in the sale price and in the alleged negotiations between Mr. Staskavich, Mr. Morse, and Mr. Rader when they were talking about the sale price. In the same manner, they're not allowed to do anything that will make it impossible to carry out the business of the partnership without a vote and approval of all the limited partners. That also did not occur here. In another example, the limited partners are allowed to have a vote for anything that would dissolve the partnership, and upon sale of the only asset or all of the assets of the partnership is to be dissolved. And so they've breached the partnership agreement in several key ways. I would like to reserve my remaining moment. Thank you.
Your Honors, my name is Eric Musselman, and I represent the appellees, who are the general partners of HMC. Mr. Rader is present today. The issue here in this appeal is whether the trial court correctly held that independent counsel was disinterested, independent, and employed reasonable procedures in his investigation. Mr. Porterfield, independent counsel, prepared a report to the trial court recommending dismissal of the claimants, Day and Barnes, derivative claims. The underlying transaction at issue at the trial court level that's been challenged is a limited single transaction. HMC sold property to one of its general partners, Mr. Rader, who recused himself from HMC deliberations and its vote on the transaction. There was an offer and a counteroffer. There was deliberation, all in the meeting minutes of HMC. And in addition, the two general partners who made the decision, Steskavich and Morse, were not on both sides of that transaction. In Colorado, the rule is that the trial court conducts a deferential and limited review of independence, disinterestedness, and reasonableness. And that's because the Colorado Business Judgment Rule applies to bar judicial inquiry into the actions of corporate directors taken in good faith and in the exercise of honest judgment and reasonableness in furtherance of the corporation. Here, the trial court did not get to any review of independent counsel's business judgment because there was no finding of a missing element, independence, disinterestedness, or reasonableness.
Well, sorry to interrupt, but do you think it's reasonable to not have an appraisal done or have some kind of an expert weigh in on this?
Yes. And the reason I believe that is for the simple fact that at the time of the transaction, which was in 2005, the parties had been involved in several types of efforts to sell or market the property, including work with Mr. Barnes. And as a result, after the gambling initiatives failed in this particular area, the issue became what, if anything, that the partnership could do to stop incurring losses on this property. So an expert today is distinct from what an expert would have said in 2005. I mean, 2000, and the experts we have you know, been addressed in this case all did a retrospective look at a property based on 2005 values. This whole property was a gamble. And the reason that it was a gamble was because the gambling initiatives failed. And Mr. Barnes even spoke to that issue, and that's in the report on page 9, where he addressed that this is the type of property that a developer would likely not be interested in. I'm not, you know, quoting him precisely, but that was the specific issue.
So how does he know that? I mean, if he's going to reach that conclusion, he's investigating the decision of the two partners who remained in and who sold this. He's investigating that, and he makes a judgment that nobody would have bought this, I guess, is what his judgment is. How does he know that?
When you say he, Your Honor?
The counsel, the independent counsel. If I'm understanding you correctly, you're saying the independent counsel made a judgment.
Yes, I'm sorry to interrupt, Your Honor. Independent counsel looked at the communications between the parties during that time, including in 2004. And Mr. Porterfield reviewed that at that time, that Mr. Barnes' opinion was that it was unlikely that a developer would be interested in purchasing the property in its current state. And that was one of the issues that he looked at. I apologize. Mr. Porterfield looked at Mr. Barnes' opinions concerning the value of the property.
What informed those opinions?
And you say what informed Mr. Barnes' opinions?
Yes.
That I do not know. Mr. Barnes has not been deposed in this case, and that has never been addressed because the derivative claims were dismissed.
Mr. Barnes, it was a plaintiff. He was bringing this suit, this derivative suit.
Correct. That is not my client's position on the value, but that is Mr. Barnes' position in late 2004 concerning that property.
Well, so let me follow up on Judge Furman's question. And the trial court, in its order granting dismissal, said that the key factor, this is the trial court's words, was the price of the property at the time of its sale, and said, I'm going to look at, and the independent counsel looked at 05 instead of 07. Let's just assume that's right. So then the trial court said the independent counsel did not have the property appraised because such an appraisal would reflect today's value. There is such a thing as retroactive appraisals, isn't there? Didn't that happen all the time? An expert could have said, what was this property worth in November of 05 or September of 05, whatever the date was.
Agreed. But as to the prerequisites that were at issue for independent counsel for today, it was important for independent counsel to determine what was known by the general partners who were disinterested at the time that they agreed to enter into the transaction. What Mr. Porterfield did, instead of seeking expert appraisal, Mr. Porterfield went to the meeting minutes of the general partners during that particular time, and he also went to the correspondence so that he could gain an understanding of what was really going through the minds of the general partners who agreed to enter into this transaction.
But apart from what was going on in their minds, wouldn't it be fundamentally unreasonable? It's an insider transaction. Two partners are selling to another general partner. This is an insider transaction, is it not?
Yes, it is.
Okay. So, and the burden on the partnership as a whole is to show central fairness in this transaction.
That is correct.
And the trial court and the independent counsel, I think, said as well that the key factor is the value of the property at the time. And I'm having trouble saying independent counsel spends 30 hours, including a lot of just background legal research, but declines to take the very simple step of hiring an expert and saying, what was this worth at the time? Again, very conflicting information. I'm getting that the general partner saying it's worth $250 based on a Garfield County tax assessment, and I'm getting the derivative plaintiffs claiming it's worth maybe 10 times or more as much as that. I mean, wouldn't a reasonable procedure be for this independent counsel to just hire an independent appraiser and say, tell me how much it was worth at the time?
In retrospect, yes, it would have been helpful to have an independent appraisal. Mr. Porterfield's report, however, addresses the concept that he was attempting to determine what, in fact, the general partners had available to them at the time. I think the
Sorry to interrupt, but while I'm thinking about that, what informed the general partners?
What informed the general partners at the time?
Because they didn't have an independent appraisal done.
That's correct.
So what informed them? It sounds like everybody's guessing.
Well, I think that, firstly, given that the property was speculative, that it would have been very difficult to actually get a reasonable appraisal.
Well, that's speculative.
Agreed.
Okay. You don't have an expert saying it's pretty hard to value this or it's junk property.
Correct.
We're kind of guessing here.
Yeah, but as part of that, there were also previous negotiations concerning that property that did not relate to Mr. Rader's offer to purchase that property, which the general partners, and I'm speculating now because it's not in the record, but what they could have used to determine what they agreed upon. It appears from the record that one of the concerns that the general partners had at the time was essentially the debt on the property, which was something in line of, I think, over $60,000. And so that was one of the concerns. It was not simply just an appraisal and here's what it's for and Mr. Rader will sell it to you for that amount, but it was more of, geez, we need to get this debt off our books. And one of the ways they were attempting to do that was to sell the property. And Mr. Rader at the time appeared to be the only buyer of that, willing buyer of that property.
Is that property listed at the time, listed for sale during this time?
That I do not know, Your Honor.
And neither did the independent counsel know whether it had been listed. He doesn't say.
No, he doesn't say in his report, Your Honor, that it was listed. You're correct.
Is the best statement of your argument that these general partners had been trying to dispose of this land? They did not have a willing buyer at any price until Rader decided to make the offer, and at the time he was the only willing buyer and they couldn't get an equal amount from anyone else.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, the meeting minutes had reflected that the general partners wanted to try to develop the PUD and were unsuccessful. They were unable to. They did engineering studies, and their position was that it was beyond the partnership's capabilities financially to enter into such a development. And the minutes follow that Mr. Rader later comes with an offer, and the general partners counteroffered because they wanted to get the debt off the property. They didn't want to be burdened with it, and there was a sale that was closed 2 years later.
What about all the other violations that Ms. Butler's talking about? That, I mean, as I'm understanding it, this had to be put out for bids under the bylaws, had to be put out for bids, that it, because it was going to close up the corporation, the limited partners needed to be informed about this. They were entitled to a vote. What's your arguments on that?
The arguments that Ms. Butler pointed to were related to the closing basically of the entire, basically dissolution of the partnership. And at this point, Your Honor, that issue is an issue that needs to be addressed after this appeal is determined with respect to what independent counsel was tasked to review. Independent counsel was not tasked to review the dissolution of the partnership and whether that partnership dissolution was proper.
Well, excuse me, but I'm understanding her argument to be that because this sale, so you've got Stascavage and Morse, they're fiduciaries. They know that as soon as they sell this, it's going to dissolve the partnership, and that at that point they needed to bring in limited partners and say, okay, are you on board with the sale? Because this sale will end up with the dissolution of the partnership. What I'm understanding her argument to be is that that was part of the derivative claim, and that the that in investigating the derivative claim, Mr. Potterfield should have investigated that as well and should have rendered an opinion on that. Her argument may not be precisely that, but that's what I understand it to be.
My argument on that issue is that the transaction itself was addressed in the meeting minutes, so there was no hidden transaction here. Second, with respect to the dissolution, substantially all of the limited partners ratified this transaction, excepting Day and Barnes.
So they accept Day and Barnes, they accepted the transaction, and they all had a vote on whether to go forward with this sale.
That's correct. There was a ratification by the limited partners of the transaction. Now, the date of that, I'm not certain of.
For the sale?
I don't believe it's before the sale, but it's after the sale. I believe there's a ratification that occurred after the sale, and I believe it occurred during this dispute. That there was a ratification by all the limited partners.
After the sale.
Agreed.
Let me ask a question a bit off point. If it seems that the SLC should have obtained an appraisal or sought the advice of an expert in order to render an opinion, should he be allowed to do that?
Yes.
I mean, at this point?
Yes.
So it would be a remand, not just claims go forward?
Yeah, I agree. It should be a remand in that type of situation, because the issue would then be what weight independent counsel gives to that appraisal, which would go to his business judgment, and thus he...
That sounds more like a Delaware approach than a New York approach, if we're getting into weight of business judgment. Isn't that right?
No, Your Honor. The reason would be that independent counsel would be tasked with, I believe, providing an amended report based upon findings and his review of an appraisal, either one appraisal or multiple appraisals. But my argument would be the property remedy is remand.
And what's your authority? If we were to take that step, it would be based on our conclusion that the investigation was procedurally inadequate, that he, in the words of your opposing counsel, conducted a shoddy or shallow investigation. What's the authority for giving an independent counsel that conducts a shoddy investigation a do-over?
Well, I think that there is no case on point, but I would look to Curtis, where the issue was a stay. And the court talked about, in that case, the concept of what is required of an independent counsel. And I would argue under Curtis, and actually under Hirsch, that the Court of Appeals can remand with specific instructions as to how the independent counsel can complete a reasonable investigation.
Although Curtis, there had been no investigation conducted. It's a different case than a case, assuming we go this way, that we conclude there was an investigation conducted, but it was procedurally inadequate.
Agreed.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Butler, you can see you have about a minute and a quarter.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll pick up where you left off. With regard to Curtis, it's my understanding the holding in Curtis is that the trial courts and the courts are not to tell independent counsel what to do. Independent counsel is supposed to take that responsibility themselves and conduct an adequate investigation in light of what it is they're looking at. I also want to just point out, with regard to the $60,000 in debt, that was incurred and leaned against the property in violation of the partnership agreement, and those liens were personally guaranteed by Mr. Rader. So the argument that's being put forth that that is somehow was a driving force in Mr. Staskavich and Mr. Morris's willingness to accept this egregiously low value is difficult to understand, because it was $60,000 that should never have been placed against the property in the first place. I also want to touch on the idea of speculation and speculative, and this was a gamble. These folks bought this property in 1992, and they understood clearly what it was. They were real estate agents. They were investing in it, and they knew if the gambling initiative failed, they would still have the property and still have something to work with. The parcel they sold two lots out of that property in 2000 for $500,000 or a little bit more than that. So it's not like nothing happened after gambling and they just had to sit on this land forever.
And the election was in 92 on that
the gambling initiative election, yes, Your Honor.
I was stating to your opposing counsel what I understood your argument to be with regard to the voting of the limited partners. Was my statement an accurate statement of your argument?
Your statement was accurate, yes, that they were to have been provided votes at a couple of different points in the spectrum of what has gone on here. A couple of those votes were supposed to be approval of all. They would have had to have been unanimous. And on that point, if I may just take a couple more seconds, with the ratifications, Mr. Musselman indicated that all the other limited partners had ratified. That is not true. Mr. Barnes and Ms. Day have not ratified, but neither have Mr. Green or Mr. Brown, who are attorneys who also own limited partnership shares in this. They did not sign the ratification.
So is it your position that Mr. Potterfield, in investigating the derivative claims, whether to go forward with them, should also have investigated whether the general partners breached their fiduciary duties when they failed to give the limited partners prompt notice before the sale and give them an opportunity to vote on whether to go forward with the sale?
Correct. That was part and parcel of the entire breach of fiduciary duties on so many levels with respect to Staskavich, Morse, and Mr. Rader, and Mr. Porterfield did not focus his investigation at all on Mr. Rader.
Having not addressed that, then also his recommendation was flawed.
Exactly. His investigation was shallow and pro forma.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. The case now stands submitted. An opinion will issue in due course.